For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, two more books up for the Booker Prize 2023. Later on in today's show, we'll hear a clip of the audio version of Western Lane by Chetna Maru. But first up, in The Bee Sting by Paul Murray, the Barnes family is in trouble. Dickie's once lucrative car business is going under. But rather than face the music, he's spending his days in the woods building an apocalypse-proof bunker with a renegade handyman. His wife Imelda is selling off her jewellery on eBay, while their teenage daughter, Cass, formerly top of her class, seems determined to binge-drink her way to her final exams. And 12-year-old PJ is putting the final touches to his grand plan to run away from home. Where did it all go wrong? A patch of ice in the tarmac, a casual favour to a charming stranger, a bee caught beneath a bridal veil. The audio version of The Bee Sting is read by multiple narrators.
Since the closure of the garage in the next town over, her father has stopped saying things would get better. They knew how bad things were. The whole town knew. Old ladies would come up to Dickie after Mass and tell him they had said a novena for him and for the motor industry in general. Others steered clear, as if his failure might be catching. Sometimes when Cass walked into a shop now, everything went quiet, and she felt shame prickle over her, like a hideous second skin. A new adversity arrived to take place of her eczema. The crisis had transformed Main Street into a mouthful of cavities. Businesses big and small shuttered in its aftermath. Yet the collapse of the garage was felt by the townsfolk to be of a different order. A fall as dizzying as the Barneses couldn't come from simple economics. There had to be a moral element. Many of them felt that Imelda was to blame. Dickie made a fortune and Imelda spent too. That was what people said. Imelda, with her cheekbones and her Italian leather boots, got up like the Queen of Sheba just to drive to the supermarket, giving the poor manager an earful because they didn't have star anise or tamarind or whatever was supposedly all the rage in New York. It's a long way from tamarind she was reared, they told each other darkly. It's a long way from underfloor heating and orthodontists or any of that palaver. Well, look at her now.
The Bee Sting is about a family living in a town in the Midlands of Ireland, and they've gone from being sort of big wheels in the town. So the dad, Dickie Barnes, runs the local Volkswagen dealership. So during the kind of the good times, the boom here in Ireland, they've been very wealthy. And then when the crash comes, business is it's almost wiped out, and the family starts to sort of disintegrate under the pressure.
The woods of Belarus are a maze. A green, snow-laden maze that switches itself around whenever he turns his back. It's winter. The cold is blistering. The enemy is everywhere. Grey flashes in the branches, almost too fast to see. "Behind you!" Nev calls. PJ spins round just in time to see a rifle pointed right at him, a shadowed figure fix him in his sights. "Incoming!" He hurls himself into a hollow as the grenade comes down, rolls with the blast, crashes against a tree trunk, hauls himself to his feet and runs without looking back into the trees, the light. "This way," Nev calls, going the wrong way.
Each of the family member tells a part of the story. So it starts with Cass. She's the daughter. She's 17 and she's hoping to go to college in Dublin if she gets through her exams with her best friend Elaine. Then PJ tells the next bit, and he's 12. He's worried that his parents are going to get divorced and he's going to be sent to boarding school. And he's basically trying to stay out of his parents' way as much as he can. So there's a woods behind the house. He spends a lot of time there with his sort of frenemy, Nev, and also with the mysterious interlocutor who sort of he's only met online. Then there is the mum, Ismelda. She's kind of a famous beauty. She's from a different background to the rest of the characters. She's from a very poor background. So when we get to her section, we start to go into the past and we discover that there's a lot more to the parents' lives than we've thought from having seen them through the kids' eyes. And there's a lot of sort of, you know, there's a lot of sort of trauma and grief that has been kind of buried under the surface for a long time. And Dickie, he's the dad then. Similar story. Like we go into his past too, and it's pretty different to what we thought it might have been.
The hole is 4 feet wide and almost as deep as a man. They take turns digging, PJ too, in the beginning, though after they get to a certain depth, Victor puts a stop to it. If the walls collapsed, they would bury him. First, the soil was light and springy, little more than tree roots and dust. Now it is dark and claggy and sticks to the spade. Dickie digs, or Victor. PJ stands at the edge of the hole, ready to receive the bucket and empty it. Access to water is the first and most crucial requirement of self-sufficiency. According to the three threes, a body can last 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water, 3 minutes without oxygen. All things being equal, oxygen shouldn't be an issue. Food you can store and forage for, but water, that's the tough one.
Dickie's obsessed with being a good person. So he really wants to be good, seen as a good man in the eyes of the town. So he's very active in, you know, he gives to the local football club and he employs anybody sort of who's unemployable in his garage. And he really wants the garage, the business, to succeed because, you know, he doesn't want to have to let his employees go. But he's so busy being good that he's kind of sort of buried his true self for a long time. And now as everything sort of, you know, comes to a head, we find the kind of the past beginning to rise up into his life, and then and from there into the rest of the family's lives.
And it's set in quite a small town, a place where you see people in cars slow down to see if they know you. But you grew up in the city of Dublin. How did you capture that small town feel?
I guess like my mum is from a very small town up in County Monaghan, and I think I drew on that a fair bit for Imelda's past certainly, and my dad's from Galway, which is not a small town, I should stress. I guess a couple of friends of mine from school and from college married girls from the Midlands, like in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. And they would just tell me stories of adventures they had had in the Midlands, and their wives would tell me stories about, you know, growing up in the Midlands. And I was really attracted to the idea of the small town where, you know, in a city. Like Dublin's not a huge city, but it's big enough that you can kind of disappear. You know, you can have different sort of identities or live in different ways, you know, at the same time. Whereas in a small town like the one in the book, you're always being observed. You know, everybody's watching and everybody's judging. And like you know, there's good things about that. You know, it can be supportive, and you know, you can find that when you're in trouble, people will rally around to help you. But equally, you can find that if you go against what the townspeople think is the right thing, then you can really find yourself in trouble. And that's what happens in the book. So just that idea that, you know, you're a small town is somewhere. I think each of the characters in a different way wants to escape. You know, they want to escape their lives, and they want to escape that sense of having to conform to this idea that the townsfolk have of them.
Now, there are four different voices in the book. So, and of varying ages, did you have to research things like gaming terms for PJ?
Like no, I think I'm sort of I'm kind of fairly good at just sort of absorbing those things just from like looking at the newspapers or whatever. I guess the hardest one for me was Cass, who's the teenage girl. I met a couple of millennials. I had millennial consultants that I met just once when I'd sort of started writing her section, and I just wanted to sort of see did what I was writing, did the sort of trajectory her life was taking, did that sound authentic to them, you know? And that was really, really helpful. Like I feel like if you're feeling really tentative about us, like if you're feeling like, you know, oh, I'm not sure this character is actually sort of authentic or not, it's not working. Like if you have to research us, my sort of sense would be then it's not. That voice is never going to sound kind of like fully confident. But with her voice, like I had an idea of what she sounded like and what she would think about. And I did sort of check that out, as I say, with these two kind of millennial consultants. And they said, totally, this completely sounds right to us. So that was great. And that was all I needed. And then I kind of pushed on from there. I think if you're a reader, you do have a certain sense of familiarity with lives that are sort of ostensibly quite different to yours. So if you grow up reading books by like whoever it might be, by women writers, Judy Blume. When I was a kid, I read a lot of Judy Blume. And then like reading Laurie Moore, she writes about female friendship very beautifully. And Elena Ferrante, likewise. Like all those books resonated with me. So it didn't feel like a huge leap. And then with PJ, like so PJ's 12 and he's a gamer, but whatever it says about me, like I felt like still I could kind of connect with my own youth there, being kind of a slightly lonely gamer, trying to escape from like the monotony of like 12-year-old life in fantasy and in like computer games. So all of those stories, all of them felt like fairly natural to me. Like once I got rolling, all of those voices just appeared, which is a blessing.
Will he say it to him at all? Or will he let him slip off back to the Algarve? He still doesn't get it, does he? Born with a silver spoon in his mouth, he still doesn't see what's coming at them. You're a martyr to that man. That's what the girls say. The things he put you through, Imelda. Beside her, the kids both buried in their phones till Maris turns in his seat. You're awfully quiet, he says. Are you there at all? Imelda nudges PJ. No point talking to the other one. Your granddad's speaking to you, she says. PJ looks up, wild-eyed, like he's just been pulled out of a dream. How's that game? Is it the right one? The fellow in the shop said it was the latest installment. Yes, no, it's definitely the right one. Thanks a million, PJ says. What is it, World War II, fighting the Nazis? Right, only this one's set in the present, so like if the Nazis had won the war, it's an alternative reality. Alternative reality, is it? Morris says. He turns back around. Well, they couldn't do much worse a job than the current shower.
Now, one thing I missed by listening to the audiobook was the fact that Imelda's punctuation free was that hard to write? And well, I think the narrator put the punctuation in naturally as they were narrating it, but was that a hard thing to write without punctuation?
No, it was the opposite, really. It was I hadn't given much thought to, like, the book is sort of written like linearly, like as you know. So I wrote Cass's section first and then and PJ's, and then I came to Imelda's, and I hadn't given much thought to how I would put her story together. And I just started writing as, and she's on the way to, when you sort of meet her for the first time, or when you hear her speak for the first time, rather, she's on her way to this very kind of stressful family dinner. Like sort of, it's a celebration of Dickie's father, Morris Barnes, in the town. So all the local bigwigs are going to be there and everybody's going to be dressed up. And she knows that the family has to impress, and she's very anxious about it. And she's got a particular reason for not wanting to go back to the hotel where this dinner is on, which carries these sort of memories for her. So I started writing that section, and she's in the car and she's thinking about how much she doesn't want to go to this dinner, and I was punctuating it as normal, and it just felt wrong in this really kind of. You've got these gut feelings that you have when you're wrong, and you can't really explain them. Like you can explain them like in retrospect, but at the time they just feel, something just tells you this isn't quite right. So I just took the punctuation out. The punctuation is there. That makes it sound sort of very kind of experimental and arty, but it's actually, from what I'm hearing from readers, like it's not hard to read. So there's sort of punctuation of sorts in that, like a new sentence, it won't have a full stop. There won't be a full stop at the end of the last sentence. But the new sentence will have like a capital, so you'll be able to kind of tell that it's a new sentence. But it was really, for me, it was about the rhythm. It was really about getting the sound of her thoughts, and the punctuation was getting in the way of that, and that's why I took it out. Like I really wanted you to feel like inside her head, and like she's speaking to herself, and you're kind of like you're kind of listening in on those thoughts, because she's her section is kind of different to the kids' sections. Like it's really, like I say, you've been seeing the parents through the kids' eyes up until then, and the parents seem quite kind of, like the way you see your parents when you're a kid. Like they seem kind of one-dimensional, and they're obsessed with these kind of quite petty things, like whatever, underfloor heating or wearing the right shirt. So then when you got to her section, I really wanted it to feel like you're plunged into this world that is very, very intense, that you didn't know existed. So getting it right was not about the punctuation. It was more just about like just getting the sounds of the sentences to feel, to kind of getting the weight of the words right, and getting it to flow in a very particular way. And so the audiobook was, in the way the audiobook is like a perfect medium for that. And I know the producer of the audiobook, his name is Gray Everly, he works at Penguin. And he worked so hard to find the right cast for each part of the book. And I was quite sort of nervous about having, when it sort of when it goes into the audiobook, it's a different way of telling the story. It's a different medium. And it's very different. But he picked these fantastic actors, and they did like just an amazing job, I think, on
Yeah,
the work.
the actors are Heather O'Sullivan, Barry Fitzgerald, Beau Holland, Kieran O'Brien, and Lisa Caruccio-Cammy. Did you have any input into the casting at all?
Yeah, I did. I did. I mean, it was really Gray's like production, but he would send me the audition samples from each actor. So there'd be sort of like there'd be like maybe four or five actors auditioning for each of the roles. And like for me, it was difficult. Like that's not my field. So they're all like everybody I heard was really good. But I guess it was getting the accent right was well, that was what stood out for me, like just being able to get the accent, like that Midlands accent, and getting to sort of to express. It was just, yeah, I think that I, so I would make my call and say, well, this person is my favorite, because they might have the accent, as I say, was what stood out for me. And they would sort of the Greg and the others would sort of go off and huddle, and they'd make the final selection. But I would always have input, but my input would end there. So the only things I would sort of have I'd be consulted on further was so the last section. So each character tells a part of the story, and then at the end, the final section, it kind of flips from one character to the next, and as that section progresses, the flipping becomes faster and faster and faster. So you're just getting one line from each character. And then the last line is unattributed. So Gray wanted to know like who was going to say that line in the audiobook. So that's kind of one of the big differences between the audiobook and the novel, in the written novel. On the page, you don't see who's saying it, and on the audiobook you do.
Yeah, I wouldn't say anything, but yeah, I know the actor who
Same word, yeah.
delivers that last line. But The Bee Sting is available in audio and braille, as is Skippy Dice. Is it important for you that your books are available in alternative formats?
Oh man, absolutely, of course. Yeah, it's like you really want as many people as possible to read the book. That's why anybody who writes a book, like it's to kind of connect with readers. And so yeah, it's absolutely important to me. I would really hate the idea that anybody would be excluded from reading us. So it's important to me, definitely, that there's enough copies in libraries, for instance, or that it's available in Braille, or that it's available in audiobook. And that's and Penguin is really great with the with your I mean, I guess audiobooks have really kind of increased in popularity in the last sort of few years, and they take it very seriously, and they do a really good job on it. So and I hear from people, like I meet people who like aren't able to read the printed book for whatever reason. And I find it quite heartening, quite moving when they really sort of say, oh, the audiobook, the publisher did a great job, and it really felt, they were able to kind of connect with us in exactly the same way.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book from RNIB's library is the cover. Can you tell us a little bit about the cover?
Yeah, so the cover was done by a guy called John Gray, who's I think it would be fair to call him like a design legend at this point. He's really done like so many any number of incredible sort of book jackets. So I was really excited when I heard that he was going to do this my book. And it's a really eye-catching image. So booksellers will tell me, like if you go into the bookshop, like it sort of jumps off the shelves. It's yellow and black. So it's B colors. My name is in the middle in black letters, and the book's title, Bee Sting, is beneath that in orange letters. The background is yellow, and there's a bee in the top right corner, and the bee's kind of line of flight has been kind of traced around the letters of the, or traced around the title and the author name. But instead of being sort of like a wavy, sort of curvy line of flight like you might expect from a bee, it's all been done in these kind of like rigid straight lines. So there's lots of straight lines and right angles, with the effect that like it looks like a labyrinth. It looks like kind of a maze surrounding the title and the author name. So it gives a sense of like this the plot, which is quite labyrinthine, and also kind of like the characters are kind of enclosed, trapped inside this story that they're not in control of.
Well, now the cover also has that little sticker that says shortlisted for the Booker. You were first nominated in 2010 for Skippy Dies. Does that feel different this time round?
Yeah, it does, actually. I mean, I think I was so kind of astonished with Skippy Dies that I kind of wasn't really able to take it in. This time it was a big story here in Ireland because there was four Irish authors longlisted. So that it became sort of like a big kind of new story. And to get from the longlist to the shortlist didn't happen with Skippy Dies. I mean, that's like it's like another dimension again. Like there's so much excitement about it, so much publicity about it. So it's like it's really like a phenomenon, you know. So the last kind of few months have been pretty much about the Booker and not much else. So it's like it's a crazy time, like it, but it's wonderful. Like I don't think there's any other prize that has that kind of level of excitement. And
now, as you say, apart from half the shortlist being called Paul, there were four Irish authors on the long list and two went on the shortlist. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a good time for polls. So there was four of us on the long list. So Sebastian Berry and Elaine Feeney were with us on the long list. Then myself and Paul Lynch went through to the shortlist. And I mean, I don't know. It's Sebastian Berry said, let's just call it a miracle. And in some ways, that's as much as you can say. But I think Ireland, like, it's a country where through good times and bad, and there've been a lot of good times or bad times here, like historically, it's always been a culture that valued reading. So just people read books. You know, a lot of people here read books, and books are part of the kind of the national conversation in a way that they might not be in other countries. So writing is something that people feel like they can do. And I think that's the most important thing. And then sort of like the kind of the background to that, you've got the state, there's a fair bit of support from the state in terms of like there's an Arts Council, which is very supportive of authors, like both starting out and established. There's a tax exemption here for artists. So that helps too, you know, because like writing obviously isn't something that makes you like a massive amount of money most of the time. So you can kind of get by as a writer, and you're recognized as a writer, and that work is seen as like, you know, having kind of an importance or a value in a way that it might not be elsewhere. And like stuff like, I mean, I spent a semester in the US last year, and people were saying like, how can you be a full-time writer? Because in the US it's impossible. No, it's because there's no health system unless you're rich, you know, you can't afford, unless you can afford health insurance. If you get sick, you're in really serious trouble. Whereas here, that's not the case, you know? So the older I get, the more I realize that like, it's actually, you know, it's a lucky situation to be in, like being an Irish writer, that's a good place to write.
Of course, in the eyes of the world, it is a disaster to be kicked out of the family business, to lose the job he'd been groomed for since he was a child. He doesn't know how he's going to explain it to Imelda. Still, as he steps back onto the street, Dickie feels like jumping for joy. His father is gone. The missing money will stay an unsolved mystery in a ledger on a drive. And Dickie's secrets too will remain buried in the past.
The Bee Sting by Paul Murray is available now in print as an e-book and in audio as read by Heather O'Sullivan, Barry Fitzgerald, Bo Holland, Kieran O'Brien and Lisa Caruccio-Cami. It's also available from RNIB Talking Books in audio and braille. And Paul, thank you so much.
Thanks, Herbert.
And Paul Murray will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and The pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports talking books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. Now it's time to hear about some brand new audiobooks available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books.
For fans of psychological thrillers, I Know It's You by Susan Lewis has recently arrived from HarperCollins.
I think it might work for you, Noel Hadigan is saying, seeming both certain and curious as he assesses the landing of his proposition. His eyes are mischievous, and then less so, as he gives a quick wave to someone he knows. Bad choice of restaurant. He can never come to the Ivy in Covent Garden without being recognised, and he'd much rather be focusing on the woman seated opposite him. Marina Forster treats him to one of her famously wry smiles as he turns back to her. She's always happy to spend time with this man, especially when he's up to something, and he clearly is. So it's easy to allow her turquoise blue eyes to show interest, in spite of having heard him start a pitch this way many times before.
The first chapter of a manuscript arrives on publisher Marina's desk. She assumes it's just another novel by another aspiring writer. As the chapters arrive one by one, Marina is convinced they're about her past. There's only one person who can know everything about the scandal, the trial, and the trauma that nearly broke her. This is one story that should never be told, and Marina is so desperate she will do anything to stop it getting out.
She's a tall, strikingly lovely woman in her mid-40s, with thick, dark hair, usually wound into a single French plait. Delicately pale skin, lusciously defined features, and an air of confidence that's easily matched by her natural warmth. Her reputation for being a great boss and insightful publisher is, according to most, entirely deserved. For, over the past 11 years, since returning from the hiatus of becoming a mother, she's steadily built up the dedicated fiction division of Hawksley Maine, an international publishing house. It is now an award-winning, widely respected, and highly profitable arm of the business. She'd even name the imprint Janus, after the god of beginnings, transitions, and endings. Can't wait to hear what it is, she teases, and pops a forkful of deliciously baked salmon into her mouth before raising a glass of sparkling water. He knows, as do most literary agents in town, that she, as an executive publishing director, rarely takes on a new work. She has a superbly talented and mostly independent team for that. However, there are exceptions. Usually they come in the shape of celebrities or politicians whose egos and agents insist on being handled by the person at the top, even if the actual editing is carried out by a senior member of the team. It's coming from an unknown, he tells her. Unless the name is a pseudonym. And I guess that's likely. All I have right now are initials and a surname. Don't tell me. J.K. Rowling. He laughs. Hardly unknown. But certainly, Rowling set a trend, and it isn't such a bad one, if you don't want your identity to influence early judgment. So, are you thinking someone famous could be behind it? He shrugs. Too soon to say, but the author is definitely going for gender neutral right now. And the first chapter is... He searches for the right word and is clearly disappointed in himself when all he can muster is interesting.
I Know It's You by Susan Lewis is read by Laura Kirkman, Helen Stern and Claire Will and runs for 10 hours, 41 minutes.
There are many readers who love an historical mystery. New in the library, The Birdcage Library by Freya Berry was donated by Headline.
Every life has its own lie. I think of them as like plants. Lies, I mean. Doubtless this is due to my botanist's profession. Some are tame and neat. Cottage garden geraniums, sprucing up the exterior. Others are subtler, wilier. Their roots sunk deep. There is a third kind, the creepers, the vines. Plants of the jungle, parasites. Lovingly they reach up and in, entwining themselves with their host, slowly but surely leeching its life away. The train snaked up Scotland's west flank, coiling through the peaks of Argyll, winding its way around Lochlinnie. The landscape grew bleaker, green bowing to red bracken, not dissimilar in colour to my hair. My skin gleamed pale in the window, paler since our arrival. My father and I had spent 7 years absorbing the Australian sun, only for it to disperse in a matter of weeks. I felt guilty for leaving him, though I could hardly have refused the fortuitous employment offer I'd received.
It's 1932. An adventuress and plant hunter, Emily Blackwood, accepts a commission from Heinrich Vogel, a former dealer of exotic animals in Manhattan, living now with his macabre collection in a remote Scottish castle. Emily is tasked to find a long-lost treasure which Heinrich believes has been hidden within the castle walls. But instead she discovers the pages of a diary written by Hester Vogel, who died after falling from the Brooklyn Bridge. Hester's diary leads Emily to an old book, the Birdcage Library, and into a treasure hunt of another kind, one that will take her down a dangerous path for clues and force her to confront her own darkest secret.
The train was a rickety-looking thing, with an air of frontier bravado. I changed onto it at Glasgow and made sure to request my stop with the gaunt conductor, as my new employer had directed in his letter. The handwriting was elegant, flared. "They're all request stops here, Miss Blackwood, Emily Blackwood." He nodded bleakly, returning my ticket as a bishop dispenses a wafer to a sinner. His lugubriousness was at odds with the countryside's vaulting magnificence, but it seeped in as we left tourist country with its viaducts and waterfalls, pretty train stations and tamed lochs, the winding roads that led nowhere, and the white crofters' cottages pebbling the bracken like rocks' eggs in a giant nest. The sky outside grew greyer, draped over humpbacked hills that somehow both crouched and loomed. The stations grew smaller, or perhaps the hills reared higher. This far north, nature had different rules. I saw it in the passengers, iron under their skin. It was easy to believe that wolves had lived here once, sleek shadows winding through the pines. It was a long way from the cloud forests of Papua. I'd been on expedition there, collecting new and rare plants not 5 months since. It was on a brief visit to Port Moresby to pick up an insulin shipment that I received a frantic message from my childhood friend Daniel Lowe. It said that the small but adequate funds he had been managing for my father and me had been lost. All of it. In the roilings of the Depression. I'd returned immediately to Sydney to organise our affairs, then booked us a cargo ship back to England. All we could now afford. Though at least I talked us into a cabin.
The Birdcage Library by Freya Berry is read by Samara McLaren and Lauren Allman and runs for 14 hours, 17 minutes.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Another entry on the Booker shortlist this year is Chetna Maru's Western Lane. And while we didn't manage to secure an interview with Chetna, we will have a listen to the book. 11-year-old Gopi has been playing squash since she was old enough to hold a racket. When her mother dies, her father enlists her in a quietly brutal training regime, and the game becomes her world. Slowly, she grows apart from her sisters. Her life is reduced to the sport, and guided by its rhythms. The serve, the volley, the drive, the shot, and its echo. But on the court, she is not alone. She is with her pa. She is with Ged, a 13-year-old boy with his own formidable talent. She is with the players who have come before her. She is in awe. The audio version of Western Lane is read by Mia Saroya.
I don't know if you've ever stood in the middle of a squash court, on the tee, and listened to what is going on next door. What I'm thinking of is the sound from the next court of a ball hit clean and hard. It's a quick, low pistol shot of a sound, with a close echo. The echo, which is the ball striking the wall off the court, is louder than the shot itself. This is what I hear when I remember the year after our mother died. And our father had us practicing at Western Lane 2, 3, 4 hours a day. It must have been an evening session after school, the first time I noticed it. My legs were so tired I didn't know if I could keep going, and I was just standing on the tee with my racket head down, looking at the sidewall that was smudged with the washed-out marks from all the balls that had skimmed its surface. I was supposed to serve, and my father would return with a drive, and I would volley. And my father would drive, and I would volley, aiming always for the red service line on the front wall. My father was standing far back, waiting. I knew from his silence that he wasn't going to move first, and all I could do was serve and volley, or disappoint him. The smudges on the wall blurred one into the other, and I thought that surely I would fall. That was when it started up. A steady, melancholy rhythm from the other court, the shot and its echo, over and over again, like some sort of deliverance. I could tell it was one person conducting a drill, and I knew who it was. I stood there, listening, and the sound poured into me, into my nerves and bones, and it was with a feeling of having been rescued that I raised my racket and served. There were three of us, all girls. When Ma died, I was 11. Kush was 13. Mona, 15. We'd been playing squash and badminton twice a week ever since we were old enough to hold a racket. But it was nothing like the regime that came after. Mona said that all of it, the sprints and the ghosting and the three-hour drills, started when our Aunt Ranjan told Pa that what we girls needed was exercise and discipline, and Pa sat quiet and let her tell him what to do. That was at the beginning of autumn. The weather had turned from unseasonably dry and warm to humid.
A clip of Mia Saroya reading from Western Lane by Chetna Maru. In an interview, Chetna says, in the novel, we see the world through the eyes of 11-year-old Kobe. She and her sisters have recently lost their mother. Their pa is bereft and struggling to parent his daughters. At the same time, the girl's aunt and uncle watch the family, hoping to help Pa by taking one of the girls to raise as their own. As she was writing, she was feeling her way. She didn't have to plot or outline for the whole novel, and she had a sense that the story would turn on this one question. Would Pa bring himself to let one of his daughters go?
The air was oppressive, and the street smelled of decomposing food. In this heat, a number of days after Ma's funeral, we had driven 400 miles to Edinburgh to have a meal at our aunt's home to mark the end of our mourning period, and Aunt Ranjan told Pa we were wild. We were right there in her kitchen with her and Pa when she said it. Mona was washing potatoes in the sink. Her head was bowed and her sleeves were pushed to her elbows because she wasn't just rinsing the mud away. She was really scrubbing. Her ponytail swung over one shoulder. Kush was peeling slowly, staring out of the window. I was at the table seeding pomegranates. Aunt Ranjan had scolded Kush for wearing her hair loose in the kitchen, and then she'd turned to me and pulled up half of the white cloth and put newspapers down so I wouldn't get juice on her new dining set. It was a beautiful set, waxed and dark. From where I was sitting, I could see the gulab jamun Aunt Ranjan had prepared early that same morning. The dark golden balls of sponge were already soaked in sugar syrup and piled generously in a glass bowl at the end of the counter. Aunt Ranjan saw me looking. "Gopi," she said. I froze in place, blushing fiercely at the sound of my name. Aunt Ranjan stood up. She positioned herself so that she blocked my view of the sweets. I didn't know why, but it seemed important to me that I not shift my focus, that I make it seem as if I'd been looking at nothing all along. "Wild," Aunt Ranjan said a second time, her eyes still on me. "And it is no secret." Then she turned to Pa, and it was true that he just sat there, looking at nothing, saying nothing. Aunt Ranjan waited. "Well, I have said my piece," she said at last. "Now it is up to you." Pa raised his eyes to look at Aunt Ranjan for a moment, and there was a coolness in them that we were used to, but Aunt Ranjan was not. Her cheeks reddened. The pressure cooker on the gas ring gave a thin, high whistle, and the kitchen was suddenly warm with steam and the smell of overcooked lentils. Aunt Ranjan dabbed her forehead with a clean tea towel off the back of a chair. "I told Charu," she said. "I am not blaming her, brother, but I am telling you it is not too late for your girls."
Mia Saroya reading from the audio version of Western Lane by Chetna Maru. It runs for 4 hours 21 minutes and is available both commercially in print, ebook and audio, and from RNIB in audio and braille.
I'm Thibaut Fisher and this is my story listed for trial.
This is Julian Barnes and I'm reading a story I wrote called The Things You Know.
Hello, my name's Peter Robinson and I write a series of books featuring DCI Alan Banks.
This is Doris Lessing and I'm reading a chapter from my novel The Sweetest Dream.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale by Antonia Fraser.
Here is the news by Richard Baker, read by the author.
I'm Bill Bryson, reading from my book, One Summer, America, 1927.
Hello, this is Faye Weldon, and this is one of my stories. It's called Eyes in the Dark.
This morning I had my usual breakfast of toast and marmalade, which I have to have because that's Paddington's favourite.
This is Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to Talking Books.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to Paul Murray for the books of his life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
So many books from childhood. Like, that was really what we spent most of our time doing, me and my brother and my sister. We used to go to the library every Saturday and, you know, stock up, you know, these huge piles of books. So, I mean, it's hard to pick out one, but like the Chronicles of Narnia, really such a huge deal to me. Like, I remember The Hobbit, Phantom Tollbooth, all of those books were books I still think about today. I recently reread to my son, I reread Watership Down by Richard Adams, which is sort of a rabbit epic. And like, coming to it as an adult, I thought, like, there's no way he can pull off epic featuring rabbits, but he does. So it's these, if anyone hasn't read it, it's these rabbits who leave their warren. They're sort of, you know, one of the rabbits is gets a premonition that something disastrous is going to happen to the warren. So they set out, he and a kind of a, like a small group of very brave rabbits set off to find a new warren. And it's fantastic. It's just, the characterization is wonderful. And each of the stages of the quest is beautifully rendered. And there's even sort of like a rabbit mythology, these sort of stories that they tell each other about sort of the, you know, the trickster god of rabbits and his encounters, just trying to get by with sort of the mightier gods trying to crush him, and he uses his wits to get by. So that was just, yeah, that's just a wonderful book. And I was really impressed and moved by it, even reading it, you know, 35 years later.
He led the way down the slope, his shadow stretching behind him on the grass. They reached the brook and began nibbling and searching close beside the wheel ruts of the track. It wasn't long before Fiver found what they were looking for. Cowslips are a delicacy among rabbits, and as a rule, there are very few left by late May in the neighbourhood of even a small warren. This one hadn't bloomed, and its flat spread of leaves was almost hidden under the long grass. They were just starting on it when two larger rabbits came running across from the other side of the nearby cattle wade. "Cowslip," said one. "All right, just leave it to us. Come on, hurry up," he added, as Fiver hesitated. "You heard me, didn't you?" "Fiver found it, Toad Flax," said Hazel. "And we'll eat it," replied Toad Flax. "Cowslips are for Owsler. Don't you know that? If you don't, we can easily teach you." Nearly all warrens have an Owsler, or group of strong or clever rabbits, second year or older, surrounding the chief rabbit and his doe and exercising authority. Owslers vary. In one warren, the Owsler may be the band of a warlord. In another, it may consist largely of clever patrollers or garden raiders. Sometimes a good storyteller may find a place, or a seer or intuitive rabbit. In the Sandalford Warren at this time, the Owsler was rather military in character, though, as will be seen later, not so military as some. Fiver had already turned away. Hazel caught him up by the culvert. "I'm sick and tired of it," he said. "It's the same all the time. These are my claws, so this is my cowslip. These are my teeth, so this is my burrow. I'll tell you, if ever I get into the Owsler, I'll treat outskirters with a bit of decency." "Well, you can at least expect to be in the Owsler one day," answered Fiver. "You've got some weight coming, and that's more than I shall ever have." "Well, you don't suppose I leave you to look after yourself, do you?" said Hazel. "But to tell you the truth, I sometimes feel like clearing out of this warren altogether. Still, let's forget it now and try to enjoy the evening. I tell you what. Shall we go across the brook? There'll be fewer rabbits, and we can have a bit of peace. Unless you feel it isn't safe, he added.
Watership Down by Richard Adams is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Robin Holmes. And is there a book on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I won a prize. I won the Everman Bollinger Woodhouse Prize a few years ago for my book, The Mark in the Void. And one of the prizes you get is you get all of P.G. Woodhouse's books. And it turns out that he wrote 99 books. So it was a certain amount of logistical issues when they arrived in their boxes. So if it's a rainy day, I just love to kind of disappear into one of his books, you know, and I read them. I don't know which ones at this stage I've read and I haven't read, because it's more like sort of entering like a continuum. Just the way he tells the stories, it's so funny and blithe and sunny and joyful. And it just, yeah, they really like make me laugh and just make me feel like just buoyant in a way that like that nothing else ever does. If I had to pick one, I think the most recent one I read was Joy in the Morning. So that's a real beauty.
There's an expression on the tip of my tongue which seems to me to sum the whole thing up. Or rather, when I say an expression, I mean a saying, a wheeze, a gag, and what I believe is called a saw. Something about joy doing something.
Joy cometh in the mornings, sir?
That's the baby. Not one of your things, is it?
No, sir.
Well, it's dashed good, I said. And I still think that there can be no neater way of putting in a nutshell the outcome of the super sticky affair of Nobby Hopwood, Stilton Cheeseright, Florence Cray, my Uncle Percy, J. Chichester Clem, Edwin the Boy Scout, and old Bocco Fickleworth, or as my biographers will call it, the Steeple Bumpley Horror. Even before the events occurred which I am about to relate, the above hamlet had come high on my list of places to be steered sedulously clear of. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those old maps where they mark a spot with a cross and put, "Here be dragons," or, "Keep ye eye skinned for hippogriffs," but I had always felt that some such kindly warning might well have been given to pedestrians and traffic with regard to this Steeple Bumpley. A picturesque settlement, yes, none more so in all Hampshire. It lay embowered, as I believe the expression is, in the midst of smiling fields and leafy woods, hard by a willow-fringed river. And who couldn't have thrown a brick in it without hitting a honeysuckle-covered cottage or beaning an apple-cheeked villager? But you remember what the fellow said? It's not a bally bit of use, every prospect pleasing if man is vile. And the catch about Steeple Bumpley was that it contained Bumpley Hall, which in its turn contained my Aunt Agatha and her second husband.
Raymond Sawyer reading from P.G. Woodhouse's Joy in the Morning, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book, it doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend?
I would recommend Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton, which came out earlier this year, and it's kind of an eco-thriller. So it's set in New Zealand, and Burnham Wood is the name of this kind of eco-collective, which mostly sort of like 20 and 30-somethings, they're all kind of quite sort of po-faced, sort of ideological people. They're, you know, they're kind of a bit irritating. And then they meet their match in the form of an American billionaire called Robert Lemoyne. And he appears in New Zealand ostensibly wanting to sort of set up kind of a sort of nature conservation project. But in actuality, he's got all kinds of sinister plans. And Catton, she's a very, very intelligent writer. And her characterization is kind of very, you know, it's sort of very deft and funny and insightful. So it becomes a sort of head-to-head between the leader of this eco-collective, Abby, and Robert Lemoyne, this incredibly well-drawn kind of psychopathic, like, American sort of tech guy. So it's very clever, and it's very sort of the moment, but also just an absolute banger. It's a real page turner, and you don't know what's going to happen next. It's got like incredible twists, and it keeps you hooked, like right till the end, like the very last line. It'll keep you sort of just stuck to the page. So highly recommend.
The town of Thorndike, located just north of the pass in the foothills of the Korowai Ranges, was bounded on one side by the lake and on the other by Korowai National Park. The closure of the pass created an effective cul-de-sac. Cut off from the south, the town was now contained in all directions but one. Like much of small-town New Zealand, the local economy depended for the most part on the commerce of truckers and tourists passing through. And when the rescue teams and television crews finally packed up and drove away, many Thorndike residents reluctantly left with them. The cafes and trinket shops along the highway frontage began, one by one, to close. The petrol station reduced its hours. An apologetic sign appeared in the window of the visitor centre. And the former sheep station at the head of the valley, described by its real estate listing as the town's greatest ever subdivision prospect, was quietly withdrawn from sale. It was this last that caught the attention of Mira Bunting, aged 29, a horticulturist by training, and the founder of an activist collective known among its members as Burnham Wood. Mira had never been to Thorndike, and she had neither the intention nor the means to purchase even the smallest patch of land there. But she had earmarked this particular listing when it had first appeared online, some 5 or 6 months prior. Under an alias, she had written to the realtor, registering her interest in the proposed development, and asking if any of the subdivided plots had sold.
That's Saskia Marvelold reading from Eleanor Catton's Burnham Wood, which is available in audio commercially. And once again, Paul Murray, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
All we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.